Hello and welcome to the podcast for Outlander episode 103, The Way Out. I'm Ronald D. Moore, executive producer and developer of the Outland television series, and I'm joined in this week's broadcast by Terry Dresbeck, our costume designer, and by Happenstance, my wife.
By Happenstance. And Coulon.
The gin, the departure from scotch, the gin is Portobello with tonic and lime.
You made mine with Portobello?
Yours is made with Botanist.
Thank you. Dear.
Okay, 103, The Way Out. This one is...
Neville got the stitching.
She's commenting on where the credits fall in the main title. This episode is a bit of a departure from the book. In fact, this was the first time that we varied significantly from the book's frame of events. We wanted to do an episode that pretty much like posited Claire in the world of the 18th century and sort of had her deal with the fact that she couldn't leave and she was still trying to figure out a way out, but her method of doing so was to come up with basically a way of getting their trust so that they would trust her more and then believe that she was not a spy and be more likely to help her along the way.
It was all new pictures, wasn't it?
All new pictures, I told you.
Well, which one's this?
I just told you. I just said this.
That was
episode 103. The Way Out. This is the one with, you know, Claire.
I don't remember anything. This is so long ago. I do not remember this.
And the original opening to this episode, this is not the original opening.
This is amazing. Sorry.
This is so beautiful. This was written for and shot for episode 104, actually. And Brian Kelly suggested we move it up into 103 as a flashback. And then I decided, let's open 103 with this flashback to Claire leaving for the front, which I thought was just a fun riff on the traditional, you know, the soldier going off to war and his woman kissing him goodbye at the train station. And the great gag here was to flip it around and that, you know, Claire's going off to the front and Frank is staying behind.
Am I allowed to talk now?
Yes, now you may talk.
I think this is a great scene. That's all I wanted to say.
Oh, thanks, dear.
It's another feminist moment. No, I'm joking. This is just Ron thinking something's funny.
Did you, how much research do you have to do on these uniforms?
I don't do military uniforms. I really don't. I hate military uniforms with a deep passion because there are 50 million people out there who track every button and every patch and write letters and things, and it's painful. So, and I don't find them very interesting because there's no individuality really to a uniform. That's just my opinion. I'm sure people will see it differently than I do. But we did have a wonderful team of people who did put together things in a way that is beyond my expertise. I stay away from these things. But it's like the Anna Karenina moment. It's a very romantic scene, too. Look at him.
And again, you'll see that we've brought back the sort of look of World War II and the color grading. We've added a lot of grain to the film. We've sort of had the colors bleed out a little bit more than you would see either in the 40s or certainly the
Tobias. Look at that. It's just so fabulous. Tobias, look at that. I'm sorry.
That's a great shot.
So
the original opening for this was actually going to be also in World War II, but it was going to be a field hospital, and the idea was Claire and a line of other nurses were standing in line to take a shower, and they were ice-cold showers out in the field. And so you were going to do a cut from Claire being doused with ice-cold water in France in the 1940s, and then that cut was going to take you to Mrs. Fitz dumping the water on her head here at the castle. This is also a scene that's obviously not in the book, but it seemed like a fun thing that, you know, to play, not only just the gag of, you know, of it's really just Claire's imagination as she tells Mrs. Fitz, but also you just sort of wondered, you know, at some point,
doesn't
she want to tell somebody? And then what would happen if she actually did try to tell somebody, you know, what's going on?
Because you always think, you know, what would happen? Well, she'd be killed. Yeah, or thrown into an insane asylum if there was one.
This would be about the reaction. And Mrs. Fitz is the most sympathetic, nicest
this
person.
This is so great.
That she's
like, just tell me, dear. Oh, you're crazy? What are you talking about?
So, this was a part of our second block of filming. Like I've said in the previous podcast, we shoot them in blocks of two. So, episodes 3 and 4 were shot by Brian Kelly, same director. And this was our second block in the production. So this was sort of at the point where the show moved from the pilot stage into full-blown production. We're now, okay, now we're an ongoing series because now we're tackling the second two episodes.
It's so great because, you know, she's the warm and cozy Mrs. Fitz. But then you realize what would happen if you actually crossed her.
It's hard to make Katrina look bad, I've noticed in the show. It's like you really just can't make her look bad. You can dump water on her head, and you can like put her in the muck, and she always looks amazing.
She's like, I gotta get out of here before you put a hex on me.
Well, I'll just be leaving then, and I'll be burning you at the stake.
I'm gonna take my apron with me.
Take my apron with me.
Or my apron will take me. It is the best apron on the planet. It's just an apron. It's the apron of a woman who runs a castle. You're wondering here, is she going to be sympathetic? Is she going to believe her?
I don't know. Well, she plays it right up to the line.
She really does.
We tried to figure out in the writer's room how long you could sustain this, at which point would Mrs. Fitz really kind of lose her shit and start turning against her. You didn't want to cross the line. You kind of knew that the audience going in was probably thinking this wasn't real, but you wanted to play it as grounded as you possibly could for as long as you possibly could to sort of maintain the reality of it and then snap back to reality. Just continuing on that World War II theme, in the original outline and into the script, there were actually several other flashbacks to World War II that ultimately we did not shoot and discarded, starting with the field hospital, the nurses in line to take a shower. Then there was a sort of a small runner of Claire and a doctor. There was an army doctor that she sort of had a flirtation with, that he might have been interested in her, but she shied away. But that also tied into the medical story going on in the 18th century because it had to do with penicillin and different things that she was just kind of remembering as she was diagnosing illnesses back in the 1700s. But those were never started and they were all discarded along the way. This was a key thing. It was, we wanted to see Claire in her element as a nurse, you know, as a medical practitioner, you know, getting involved in all the things that were talked about in the book. You know, when she first gets to Castle Leek, one of the first things that she does is given this job by Colm to be the castle healer. We didn't do that until the end of the second episode, so now the third episode is really the first time to really play it. So we wanted to spend some time down here having her discover the different potions and things that were left behind.
One of my absolute favorites. Now, do you remember in the book, some of you when Claire keeps whipping off her fichu and headdress and, you know, there's bits of the costumes. So that was sort of my nod to that moment of a modern woman going, do I really have to keep wearing this? That, Gary built that medicine box and had it hand-painted. It's an amazing, amazing, amazing garment.
I thought this was a vintage piece that they repurposed. Did you have that built?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
We had found one when we were originally working on the lookbook for the show, and in a picture of one, and Gary was in love with it and recreated it. Now, I wanted to say another thing here. What she's wearing is called a jump. And it was basically a garment that women wore around the house, often just as another layer for warmth and comfort. And we wanted to give Claire something that she could put on the way a nurse would put on a uniform. So that last thing was what that last garment was that. Now, notice Claire is wearing a fichu. Episode 2, Claire is in a fichu. And it really... For me, it really makes it work. You know, she now really looks like she is of the place.
Now, the story that starts here, of course, is the medical mystery in the show. They hear that a kid has died and another kid is about to become ill because they went up to this place called the Black Kirk. This went through. This was the most worked over part of the script. This is originally, we started with a story that was in the book that was about meat, that the butcher of the castle was, I think his name was Rufus or something. I can't remember what his name was. And he essentially had served bad meat to some people in the castle, and Claire had sort of ferreted that out and realized that the meat was no good. And so we tried to expand on that story at first, and there was like a mystery about what was making people sick. And the ending that we were going to go for was that once Claire uncovered that, you know, it had made Angus sick, and there was this whole thing of Angus having food poisoning, and no one knew what was wrong with him. And then ultimately she found out, and the long and the short of it was that at the very end, Colm had that guy killed, had the butcher killed because he had caused all these illnesses and some deaths, and it was sort of an illustration of, you know, the hard life that these people had and how justice was swift and terrible on certain occasions. And we played with that, and we wrote several drafts and struggled with it and went back and forth and, you know, got notes from the studio network and tried different tacks. We kept hunting for the thing because then, you know, the medical notes came in and said, well, actually, food poisoning is fairly easy to detect, and people would just know because they ate all the same stuff, and they would kind of track it down kind of quickly, which is rather obvious when you think about it. So there really wasn't much of a medical mystery for her to find in that scenario. At one point, we started playing with the idea that someone was injured or ill, and Claire would have to do an emergency field tracheotomy. That went by the wayside, and eventually it landed on this idea of them going to this place that had the wood garlic. But it took a while. That was the most worked over. It was one of the storylines we struggled with the longest, actually, in the season.
Whenever possible, well, we're out of the scene now because we all had to talk for about a week. Wool in Claire, well, maybe we'll see it here. Claire's bodice, it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of vintage wool. Whenever possible, we tried to, look at that, looks great. It's the first time I've seen that. We tried to use vintage fabrics whenever we could. It's difficult to do because you can't get the meterage that you need to make the many multiples. And most of our costumes have about six of each. We have to make six of each. But anyway, that bodice is an amazing piece of old wool.
I remember there was significant discussion about this scene with Colin and the tailor. Yeah. Wasn't it originally like trues or something? What were we originally
he was going to be wearing a kilt.
Oh, it was a kilt.
He was going to wear a kilt. And at that point, I mean, this is episode 3. We were still in the let's make sure everybody's not naked phase of filming. And we just didn't have enough fabric to spare to allow a kilt to get just slashed. And it would have been really tricky. It would have been really, really difficult to pull that off anyway. I love this actor.
Oh, the tailor?
Yeah, I think he's really wonderful.
Oh, yeah, he's great. It's also one of the first period wigs that we see in the show, too.
You know, it's really interesting. You know, if you really pay attention to extras and supporting cast, there's an incredible amount of texture that gets provided there. You know, we really, this is a tricky thing to say, but, you know, people do pay a lot of attention to what our lead characters wear. They don't pay as much attention to what day players and extras wear. And that's where you can really do a lot of really nice period work that really helps to lend authenticity to the piece. There's no, oh my gosh, we have to make sure the actor looks really great kind of a pressure. So like this guy, you don't have to worry about making him fantastic. Colm's legs look great.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work. A lot of CGI involved with Colm's legs. As I think I said in episode 2, they're actually multicolored socks that then, in visual effects, they convert into these legs, and we see multiple passes on the legs, and, you know, how much flesh, what's the color tone, you know, how's he standing, where's the ankle movement. There's a lot of sort of detail, fine work goes into making Colm's legs week to week. It's a difficult gag to do.
I love Gary.
Oh, Gary's fantastic. And again, this set, this is just a tremendous set.
It's an amazing.
You just love spending time here. I still can't get over the fact that those are not real tapestries, that those are actually all hand-painted.
That's the thing to remember as you're watching the scene and you look around. I know, that's really great. But those tapestries there are hand-painted.
They're like pieces of canvas, right?
They're canvas that are painted to look like the texture of tapestry. So it's not just a painting. It's a painting that looks like needlework. It's remarkable up close.
You can come pretty close to it before you realize it's actually painted.
Really incredible. Gary.
We were going to play this more in the show. We talked in the writer's room about having more sessions with Claire and Colm and that she would return to massage him, you know, multiple times. But the truth is, you know, the story doesn't stay in Leek that long. So there really weren't that many opportunities. Once you start really focusing in on the story, this really became the only sequence where Claire was actually going to go and massage Colm. But this is something that she talked about in the book, I think.
I'm sorry, I have not seen this episode.
Yeah, so she's actually watching
it. So I'm actually watching it, sort of. I shouldn't, because...
That's okay. I should show these to you before.
You should. We should, because I just haven't had time to watch anything. Ooh, that's pretty great.
Yeah, the feet are good. I mean, the legs are good.
we were.
This was in the throes. This is in the full throes now. Now we've moved out of, hey, we're doing a pilot. Let's put on a show and figure everything out. The second episode, in our case, the second block, is where the show becomes real for the first time. Then now you're in a television series. Once you move out of the pilot, because everything in the pilot is about figuring out the fundamentals, out everything. How do you like the show?
And we had 2 weeks to make an entire. I think we saw all of Claire's. It was scheduled that we would see all of Claire's costumes within the first 2 weeks of shooting, and we had 2 weeks to make all of her costumes. It was mind-numbing.
I love the candelabra. You can see how much. That's all real wax, of course. It's just we just burn. This is the Great Hall redress. It's still the Great Hall, but now this is for Quillen the Baron, who was always in all these drafts.
Again, if you really note the extras, it's just lovely texture. Letitia.
Again, a great little beat here that's all in Gaelic, because it doesn't really matter what they're saying to each other. You just get that it's a family, and they're just saying things, father to son and mother to son. It doesn't really matter what they're saying.
And another thing that you'll notice is, as I said last week, you have to use costumes to note the passing of days, but you also have to use costumes to keep something grounded and to tell the story that people didn't have 50,000 outfits. You will see Dougal interchange between two coats. Jamie wears one outfit. Angus, Rupert, Murtaugh, they have one costume. And Rupert and Angus have one costume and Murtaugh throughout the entire show. Because that was, there was a certain reality to that as well. Especially if you're on the road a lot of the time.
Anything that has to do with musicians on the set is always complicated because you've got to record them. You've got to have what's called playback, which is something they can hear on the set over and over again. To do anything that's musical where you're seeing a character on screen that's using a musical instrument, essentially they have to be able to mime the same movements over and over again on the same tempo. So you have to have what's called a click track, which is basically like hearing a metronome on the set so that they can have the rhythm over and over again, but that that you're not playing music through all these scenes because you have to be able to do dialogue through all the scenes. And then later in post-production, our composer, Bear McCrary, works out all the exact recordings of the actual instrument and the actual voice. But anything with music is very complicated. It takes a lot of planning, takes a lot of work on the set, takes a lot of time in post-production because, all those plucking of strings on the harp are not done live on the set. They're done actually weeks and weeks later, and he's just miming to, a click track on the set itself.
See, you can really just see lovely texture there.
And the great thing to me, that one of the things that was important to me, is that all the clothes look lived in.
Yeah.
That the extras all look like, that they've been wearing these clothes around, that they didn't just pull them out of the costume truck and put them on, which is one of my big, pet peeves about period shows is that a lot of times when you're doing a period piece,
it looks brand new.
Yeah, they came out of the costume truck, and before they could get dirty, they were whisked away.
It's also important that they not look so beaten and so trashed. I fought that battle on the other side that, everybody shouldn't look like they just got dragged through a mud puddle. People have pride in their appearance. They might only have, one or two garments, but they brush it off and they present it neatly. It's the woman sitting on Claire's right, I love her. That's it. That's her.
Yeah,
good show.
We did not invent cleanliness.
We did not.
People tried to look presentable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially in something like this, where they're coming to
They're coming to court, and they're that's right.
They wanted to look right, but there were limitations to how well they could clean the clothes and how beat up
the clothes
were. They weren't sending them to
the
dry cleaners.
And then you also see a differential between the aristocracy, the middle class, the working class and the poor that, we just saw Claire have a bath. That wouldn't necessarily be true of the local farmer who's living in a hut with 10 people.
I love this whole little, this is drawn from the book, this whole little interaction with Lyra.
Oh, yeah.
Sitting there, and she's trying to chat with Jamie, and Claire's trying to help her, and Jamie just keeps going, oh, yeah, you were such a kid, and then the best is right here when he just gives her the glasses and says,
"It's so great.
Take this, will you?"
Yeah.
And just walks off. It's just so like, cool. He's such a guy.
Yeah.
He has no idea. He's interested in Claire. He has no concept that the blonde is interested in him.
Well.
Well, he does, but not in this moment. In this moment, he has no time for her at all. It's like, can you take that? Yeah.
Yeah.
See ya.
Well, now, interestingly, too, about Claire here, I don't know, but did I talk about this last week? That, you know, Mrs. Fitz runs this castle. So if somebody dies, if somebody moves out, if somebody... You know, you want Claire to be able to, I think I did talk about this last week, that Mrs. Fitz is able to pull together a wardrobe for her. Nothing too over the top, but a few pieces.
Yeah, she pulled it together from whatever they had in the castle.
Yep. But you'll notice, again, with Jamie, you're not going to see much variation. As Jamie and more about him becomes revealed, we'll start to pull in, you know, more pieces of wardrobe, because again, more pieces of costume. You're using the clothes to help tell the story and support the story. But right now, what do we know about him? Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't want any clue about anything beyond he's just an outlaw.
He's just this nice guy. He's an outlaw. Nice guy. He's out in the stable.
Yeah, we don't know anything, and so we don't want to see him changing his clothes every 4 seconds.
No. It's so funny to see him now because. Mm-hmm. Now we're still, when we're recording this podcast, we're in the middle of shooting episodes 15 and 16 of season 1. And his hair is much longer.
His hair is much longer.
And he kind of looks different.
Well, really, he looks a lot different. I think I mentioned that.
So it's funny to see Sam, like, oh, wow, that was Sam back in block 2.
Well, I did a fitting with Kat yesterday. When we did this, there were issues. We had to really work at her hair because her hair was, she had a bob. It didn't even brush her shoulders. And now it's way below
much
her shoulders.
Longer, yeah.
We were laughing and saying, look, I've known you this long. And she held up her fringe, or in America, her bangs were down to her chin.
Well, it's sad because this set isn't even there. This was like sort of home for the show was
with
these
sets.
Sam is
like a different person now.
It's all so long ago. It's almost a year
ago. Well, but see, that's what's really interesting when you shoot a show is that that everybody progresses on and off camera. And it happens in real time. So... the experience affects the actors, affects everyone, and you see it.
Well,
and if you're lucky, it reflects the story.
Well, that's one of the things I've always thought was fascinating about television, is the evolution of all of it. Because you start in a certain place, mm-hmm. and then you end up someplace else. And people, you know, I know there's a lot of people that say, oh, I had everything planned out in advance, and you knew everything that was going to happen. I think that's just a lot of bullshit, because every show sort of evolves and changes. And, okay, case in point, this television series is based on a book. We knew where we were going in terms of the basic story, the fundamental arc of it all, and who these people really were. But you watch
this show
right now, we grew. The characters grow, the sets grow, we all learned a lot.
We all grew. You know, what I knew then compared to what I know now, what Kat knew or Sam, we were all babies here, just learning how
to walk.
You'll
see the lighting change. Yeah. You'll see the makeup change. You will see us learn and build and sort of evolve. Mm-hmm. You know, as time goes on.
I haven't seen any of this stuff.
Some of that's a CGI effect. We extended the castle up there.
Enter Mrs. Fitz's knit bits. Again, knit. I can't even say that.
Mrs. Fitz's knit bits.
Okay, say it fast.
I love the whole thing with Angus. There's and her monkey shawl.
That's not her monkey shawl.
Isn't it?
No. She only has, oh, she has a monkey jacket.
Right.
This is a cape for Galus and this is a beautiful felted piece.
This garden is not outside of Castle Doom. This is actually at Kouros, which is a different village, and there was a great garden, and they have like buildings that we used for Cranesmere, which we're not in. This is supposed to be outside of Castle Leic, but we shot this in Kouros, which is also the place that we shot the Cranesmere scenes that are coming up.
You know, somebody wrote something, one of the fans wrote something the other day, and they were about how it's a great way to tell it there's a chill in the air by seeing people wearing warm clothes. It's a very basic statement, but it does tell a lot of truth. You know, if Claire were out here in a sheer cotton fichu, it doesn't tell that it's cold out there in the same way that knit piece does.
Yeah. Yeah, it speaks volumes at a glance. It tells you it's cold. Very quickly.
And again, this was one of those pieces where we just didn't have the research that really told us accurately what anybody would wear. There are bits and pieces of knit things around. And so we had to take a bit of a leap and decide that in Scotland, a place where there's a lot of wool and people have been knitting and weaving for a long time, that they could very much have had these things.
This scene, from a story standpoint, was pivotal because it's sort of an exploration of the idea about magic and superstition and its place in the series. Okay, you're watching the show, and let's say you have not read the books. You're watching the show, and you're wondering, okay, how magical is the show? Is Galis a witch? You know, is she connected to the stones? She's raising things that sound like superstition because she's talking about the Black Kirk and the devil and possession and exorcism, which Claire, the 20th century woman, says, well, that's all a bunch of crap. I mean, what are you talking about? And then Gayla says very pointedly, well, haven't you ever seen anything that you can't explain? Yeah. You know, something
outside. What is witchcraft?
Not, yeah. And then
but that's really interesting.
And then you start wondering as a viewer, well, what is the place of what quote unquote magic or fantastical? Because she has actually touched a stone and gone back in time. So you, like Claire, again, this was a deliberate attempt to marry the viewer to Claire and say, okay, you're in her point of view. What is the universe about?
Is somebody going to levitate off the
ground? Is somebody going to levitate? Is Galis going to fly off in a friggin' broom? You know, what is the deal here? I know that I've experienced something fantastical. How does that work in this
universe?
Well,
and then to go expand even further is, you know, if you plunk a radio down or a car in the middle of this culture, is that, you know, is that witchcraft? It's not a new argument, obviously, but
it's the old Isaac Asimov quote. Advanced technology, a sufficiently advanced technology will appear like magic to a, This is all sort of an expansion of the book. Sort of, you know, we wanted to give Mrs. Fitz a little bit more. We wanted to play a little bit more in her world. So we sort of brought in sort of more family for her and made, you know, Tamis, you know, I think her nephew, I believe. Yeah, it's her nephew.
Yeah.
We had to play a little bit with Tamis's coloring in post. He looked a little bit too pink and healthy when we saw the dailies, so we had to sort of make him a little bit more pale and ghostly as we went through the color grading process. And then enter Tem. Tem McInerney? I'm going to mispronounce his
sure.
I am, but Tem. We cast him. I loved him in Blackadder. If you haven't seen Blackadder, it's a great show. It's a British show, and he's like hysterically funny. And he's done many things since then, but that's what I knew him from, and we all were like really thrilled to have Tim in the show because he's just such a great actor. He's a great character actor. And Father Bane, as a character in the book, does not show up until much later, but it was interesting to bring Father Bane
give
in
him
now.
A little bit more of
give him a little bit
story.
More. Understand where his first encounter with Claire is, because you know much later in the story he will recur. He'll come back in a key way. But it was
so
good to bring.
You're building
him
a history.
Now. Yeah, you're building a history between him and Claire. And again, you're in that place of religion / superstition. Her knowledge of the 20th century. Trying to understand the place of magic in this world.
Does she interfere?
You know, it was an interesting pivot point for the character and also trying to get her and the audience to understand the world that they had entered.
Again, Angus, the wonderful Stephen.
Stephen.
You know, we helped to ground, you know, keep the show grounded by not having him change his clothes.
Does he ever change his clothes?
Mm-mm.
What about Rupert?
Nope.
That's great.
Or Murtagh.
Oh, Murtagh?
Murtagh only, at one later point, we decided that he had his father's coat rolled up in a special blanket. But no, we needed them to provide constancy and a real sense of the world that didn't rotate and didn't change.
This is a moment right out of the book of Claire seeing Lyra and Jamie, like, you know, getting hot and heavy. somewhere.
Excuse me again.
I love the fact that people tried to get me to lose that look of Jamie, where Jamie looks like sees Claire
and then
he's
goes,
kind of
back,
grins,
and
goes back and kisses
but
her.
But that's in the book. He
that's
looks
in the book.
Up, she's there
saying,
in the alcove.
Yeah.
He looks up, he sees her, and I think it says, goes back to his work.
Because at this point in the story,
he doesn't know
that he's in a love affair with this woman.
And he's 23 years old.
He's 23 years
old.
Willing
to make
he
out
better
with
be kissing her.
I love this scene.
Yeah, this is a fun
this to
movie.
Me is all, but also this is sort of the beginning of it all. This
yeah.
is when Claire starts to say when they start to
yeah.
to actually have a
I'm
an adult
on to
relationship.
You. Yeah.
But also, you know, when Murtaugh comes back later and goes, you know, don't toy
don't
with
do
him.
That.
It's
and
not
then
fair.
Lyra will be a girl
yeah.
forever.
Yeah.
Which is
he
a really
a
interesting
yes.
insight.
And it will.
Lyra.
And she will.
But yeah, this is Claire actually pushing out.
Yeah.
This is Claire active.
Yeah. She's no longer
just
you
liking
know, just,
him and like, oh,
and
you're
and
kind
also
of cute.
She's just not she's no longer living in this world like I'm an alien and I don't know where I am. And she's starting to settle in a bit.
And it's nice that you're also getting an insight into Murtaugh and his relationship
you know,
to Jamie.
It's interesting with him. I just wasn't with Duncan I had such a different picture in my head.
Well, he's described as the little Scotsman.
Oh, he's just this
little
wiry, little silver-haired guy in my head, and
well, that I, is
when,
not
when,
Duncan.
No, and when Ron showed him to me, I was like, "What?" I mean, I have my own moments of going, "That's not what I have in my head," but it is now. I mean, he owns this part.
Oh,
he's
he is Murtaugh.
Amazing.
There's no question. He's great. He's intense. He's interesting and mysterious.
Yeah.
And
again, when you look at the extras, you get to see a really wonderful texture and world that we can create. They are an enormous, enormous, enormous part of our show. We were really taken aback by how much the extras mean in this before we started. They're their own character.
This is on location at Dune Castle, outside Dune. In fact, I can see Dune outside my window right now. It's almost the same time of night. And it's tricky to light something like this at night.
Yes, we're visiting a friend. And letting us use their TV.
In the book, you know, Dougal sort of out of nowhere says, hey, I'll give you a ride to the village to sort of see Galus. And we always kind of struggled with why he was doing that. And it's still a little kind of odd that he kind of posits it. Because you don't realize until much later that there's a reason why Dougal would have anything to do with going anywhere near Galus Dungan. This is the village of Kurus, which is our stand-in for Cranesmere. You'll be seeing this a few times over the course of the season. We repainted all these buildings. Gary Steele, our production designer, had to go in and you know, we had to ask permission. We had to repaint all these buildings, but the cobblestones are really there, and that's really the exterior. Here in the Duncan House, this is what we call Galus' still room. This is actually on the set. I love the way Gary designed this. It's sort of, if you look at the interior design here, it sort of looks like the inside of a ship turned upside down. Which I understand Gary did in homage to a house that we used to rent in Berkeley, California,
yep.
which had a similar interior design and sort of ribs sort of turned upside down of a ship, right?
Yep. And that is Galus's monkey jacket.
This one? Not this one on camera right now, but the one
no,
she's wearing in
Galus's,
the scene?
Yeah.
That
it's
one?
It's a hand-felted piece.
And then she put it on backwards?
Yeah. Yeah, we gave her this fantastic coat. And it laced up the front, and she took one look at it, and this is what Lotta always does, is she takes things and puts her feet through them, and turns them upside down and inside out, and goes, what if we did it this way, and what if we did it that way? I was speaking last week about how she does that with her strings and things. So that is the front of the jacket you're looking at right now. It's really a waistcoat, I guess. And she turned it around, and it's got this, what almost looked like a spine of fur, that went down the back, and I thought, I'll have to trim that off. And she went, no, let's put it in the front, and then I'll play with it. It's really quite fantastic.
This whole thing with the boy and his ear being nailed to the pillory is right out of the book. So this is one of the things in the episode we definitely wanted to do. Everyone always knows, oh yeah, that thing where they nail the kid's ear is fantastic. It's a great moment for Claire and Jamie. It also speaks volumes about the culture of the time and justice of the time and social mores and all that. So we always knew that we wanted, that we were definitely going to include that in this episode. Doesn't she have like these, oh yeah, we just saw it a second ago, those red shoes of Galus's?
Oh.
How did she pick those, and how did they pick those out?
Well, we had this pair, we didn't have a lot of 18th century shoes. They're very, very hard to come by. And so we had this one pair of red shoes that had been sitting in the middle of the costume house. Everybody kept walking around them, and they were in the way constantly. It was like, when is somebody going to put those up on the shelf? And no one ever did. And we were out there one day, and Lotta and I were together, and she went, what are those? And like Cinderella slippers, she magically fit into them. They're very tiny because she's the tiniest person on the face of the earth. And she loved them and has worn them with every single outfit. They are her signature piece. Galus always wears red shoes.
Part of the unexpected jobs of being a showrunner is you get to have long conversations both with your sound mixers and with your studio and network executives about how loud the farts are going to be from Arthur Duncan. Is that fart too loud? Should it be more liquid than that? Should it be drier?
I don't like
you
this.
Have these like conversations about so about farts about. And you know what it's going to be.
He's so fantastic.
He's great. I love her still room. It's just really kind of witchy.
Well, if you look on the walls, I don't know if you can see them yet, but
yeah, you've seen a couple of shows.
There's a giant tarot cards blown
stencils.
Up. There's the lovers over there. You know, it's interesting, you know, a costume like this where, you know, at the last minute we're at a fitting and I look and I went, you know, we need to do something with those sleeves. And I went and grabbed a couple of leather shoelaces and just tied them up. It just adds a little touch that works really well. Most unlikely couple on the face of the earth.
This always reminds me of the relationship between in the Three Musketeers, the Richard Lester
version, with
Raquel Welch and Spike Jones, I believe, who played her husband. And she's this voluptuous, gorgeous woman. He's always, oh, my Constance. Yeah. Oh, my Constance is staying here tonight, in fact.
Yeah. He gets the shakes. Around this time is when we started getting our embroidery department. That stomacher on Claire is, I think, one of the very first pieces we did. You will see our embroidery evolve massively. We had just finally bought an embroidery machine and we're starting to do some work. Look at that. That, see that fuzzy piece down the front is, we call it the spine. Just love this. She's such a delight.
They're great together. I really like the two of them in scenes. So we look out of the set, and we cut to the location.
This is an amazing village.
Yeah, it's great. I mean,
oh
it's really great.
Remember
you can go there today,
was?
And, you know, there's like, oh, it's freezing day.
Oh, it was so cold.
So cold. I remember scouting this location, and we were walking around that square, and suddenly it just monsooned. It was just like pouring down, and we all scattered into these little bakeries and stuff that are actually, all those doors are like shops and, you know, various little places that you can go into. If you go to Kouros, you'll see it. You'll definitely be able to stand in this square and say, I was in the place where that boy was nailed to the pillory.
Oh, well, off we go.
Yeah, whatever. Another boy is here nailed. There's all kinds of little doodads in the still room. There's all kinds of like vials
so
and potions.
Scary.
It's so detailed. It has all this like stuff.
You look at the texture of that kid's clothing. It's just lovely.
And then we're downstairs. And this, I believe, is a location. I think this is a location.
Yeah, it is.
This is at Kouros, right?
It is.
Yeah, this is definitely. This is a real place.
There's your shoes. It's like, yeah, and that's one of those things, you know, we didn't plan that. That's just one of those little organic bits that happens. And when an actor, you know, says, oh, I like that, you try to go with it whenever you can, because those little parts help them to feel that character and feel real. It's so important.
It's Jeannie, you'll be seeing her again. Is that the only time we've seen Jamie in the bottom?
No, we've seen him a couple of times in it. Yeah, like I said last week, hats come and go. Well, that's just circumstantial. And you kind of, again, you kind of go with that because, you know, there's certain parts that they have to feel comfortable with. And this is the bring the cloak moment.
Oh, yeah, he brought the cloak.
We had to bring the cloak.
I love the idea that Galus was, like, trying to ferret out information from Claire. That she's, like, onto her on some level. Even though she doesn't quite know exactly what she's onto, but she knows there's something about this woman. This scene's a little imperfect. I kind of wish we'd had a chance to do a second go at this particular scene. I don't think we have quite enough coverage to sort of sell the idea of what's going on here, of Claire's distraction and Jamie, you know, swooping in to sort of get the nail out of the boy's ear. We kind of struggled with this in editing to kind of make it work. And it's sort of, I think you get the basic idea, but you kind of wish you had 2 or 3 more shots to really sell this one.
Well, there's always imperfections.
Yeah, there's always imperfections.
I'm not crazy with, you know, where her collar is, because we had to put the coat on, but she had the collar on, so why does she have the coat on?
I wish I had, like, twice as many extras in this shot.
Yeah. Sometimes it's hard to watch the parts, and you only see the flaws. You see the flaws that nobody else sees but you.
Yeah. She faints, she falls. Not sure why he knocks that thing over, but he does. It was a difficult place to walk around because those are real cobblestones that's there. And when those cobblestones get wet, it is slippery.
Not to mention, again, it was freezing.
Yeah, it was freezing. It was so cold. It's near the water, as I recall.
Yeah.
Of course.
It's right there.
There's a lock right there or something, right? It's like, and the wind comes off that water and it's really cold.
We were also finding our way with the lighting. It was really difficult for us, because it was, you'd watch things and you wouldn't really know how they were going to read on film. Like, I'll see that stomacher. You'll never see that stomacher again.
This one?
Yeah. Because it see how it jumps out. I shouldn't point these things out, but I am.
It's too white.
It's too white, but I had no way of knowing. When you look at the costume with your naked eye, it looks one way, and then we see it on camera and your heart drops. But you adjust. I don't want, it's hard to watch dailies, which is watching the footage that comes through every day, because you don't really know what it's ultimately going to look like on film. And that's just a modern invention of being able to color time things and change things digitally.
Don't remember where we shot this. I wasn't there this particular day for the Black Kirk. What was nice is it gave us an opportunity to pull in Jamie's backstory and talk about the fact that he's an educated man, he had a tutor, he speaks all these different languages. It's the first time you kind of realize, he's not just some hick.
The journey begins.
Yeah, the journey is kind of underway. You're like, oh, okay, who is this guy after all? This thing with the wood garlic and the poison and mistaking one plant for another. Took a long time to work through. We have a herbologist who, like, vets all of the scripts and medical advisors, and there was a lot of back and forth emails and conversations with the writers and our technical people to sort of get this right, and with the plant that could be there and how the plant could have got there, how the plant could be mistaken for something else, And, oh, it would have these symptoms, and then Claire would know, right? It sort of had to fulfill all these categories. It took a lot of conversation, a lot of talk to sort of get this idea of what it possibly could be that could have poisoned these boys without their realizing it, that, oh, you could have eaten this, and maybe it wouldn't kill you, but maybe it would make you very sick, but it could have killed some guys, and what would it look like, and why would they have eaten it? And it took a while to come up with this.
But in that last shot when they're walking on the wall, Jamie's wearing boots we had made that are reproductions of French military boots. You know, when you're doing a period piece like this, in Scotland, a lot of times they went barefoot because they would get foot rot if they wore shoes, which is an utterly fascinating fact. They had shoes. Yes, they did. But a lot of times people went barefoot. Well, that's impractical for us with our actors. We needed to put shoes and boots on them. And the French, since Jamie served in the French military, we decided to go that route. Same thing with Dougal and a lot of our guys. Shoes in a period piece are always an issue.
Again, right there in color timing, we took down Tamas's pallor much further than it really was on the set because he just didn't look that ill. So we made it much more pale and ashen sort of in post-production.
Mrs. Fitz's sister is wearing an Arisade, which is a woman's version of the kilt. Same, similar kind of garment, serves as sleeping bag. You use it for carrying things. It's another amazing garment.
I love this beat where Mrs. Fitz just, you don't want to cross Mrs. Fitz, even if your father banged. No. And she just goes right at him. It's like, this is my father's house, bitch.
Sisters.
Well, it was my father's before mine. That's it. And even Bane is like, okay.
Now she is wearing the Mackenzie tartan.
Yes, she is.
Because she is one of the Mackenzies. If not by blood, by, what did I say?
Allegiance.
By allegiance, yes.
There must be some blood relation.
Probably, but the point is that she is of the House Mackenzie. That is her territory. Those are her people. She wears the Mackenzie tartan.
This was tricky in editing. You had to sort of imply a passage of time that was long enough for the antidote to sort of take effect and for, you know, Tamas to recover, but you didn't want to prolong it too far, and you had to make it somewhat believable that he's recovering, you know, in real time. So there were a lot of versions of this particular moment of how long you lingered and where the dissolve was. And you can see we're starting to bring some color back to his face right there.
This is the magic of digital filmmaking that wasn't around before.
Yeah, you really couldn't do this with celluloid. For you and your little dog. Yes, we will see you again, Father Bane. It's a nice little touch here. Jamie currying the horse with just straw instead of a brush, which is a nice touch.
And Claire. Back in one of her earlier outfits, there is her skirt from the first time we saw her. I gotta watch them again, at least. If I don't watch them before, we have to remember, let me watch them again.
Yeah. So I'm kind of watching it again because I haven't seen it in months. Because I delivered this episode quite some time ago. today I was in the cutting room working on episodes 109 and 110, so this is a while ago for me too. Back to the Great Hall.
Ah, this fur that Letitia wears. Look at that. That beautiful, beautiful fur is a vintage fur coat that we repurposed and made into a 18th century wrap.
What is it, fox or something?
Yeah. It's an old piece. It's an old vintage piece.
I literally saw her wearing that again very recently.
Who?
Letitia in a different scene.
Oh, yeah.
This was tricky, figuring this out. We liked the idea in the writer's room of Will and the Bard telling a story about a woman going through stones and coming back. And there were different lyrics for the song originally, and then Jamie translating the Gaelic for Claire. And at a certain point, it really wasn't until post-production that I decided that I wanted to make the story that he tells a little bit more overtly, the story of a woman going through the stones. I think we were a little bit more metaphorical and less clear probably in the script and when they shot it on stage. And then you sort of watch it, and sometimes you watch the cut and you go, okay, I know what the intention in here was here, but we're really not being clear. So we have to just kind of spell it out a little bit more. So we went back in and rewrote this whole song. And Jamie, you'll see that we're not on his face that long. Like, we cut away rather quickly. And then we start going into these Claire's imagination, so that we could rewrite the song in a way that Jamie could tell us the story.
This was one of those moments, that flashback. We need a coat. We need a coat. It's going to be freezing and raining up there. And digging through our stuff until we found a raincoat. Throwing it on at the last second. Remember the discussions about a scarf that everybody felt it made it look... Early on, everybody was like resisting the scarf over her head. It made her look like she was middle. She was from Eastern Europe.
Oh, yeah, like she was a peasant from Russia.
Yeah, from Russia. And it was like, no, everybody wore scarves in the 1940s and 50s. Still do. Queen Mother. What a queen, I should call her. She's not the Queen Mother yet.
She's the Queen.
She's the actual Queen.
She's Her Majesty to you. This is from 101 that you probably recognize. There is a pickup shot coming up here of Frank coming back to see her that we shot much later.
Oh my God, I'm so tired. Sorry.
Try not to fall asleep. You're at the end. You made it to the end.
No, I'm not. It's just really a long week.
Yeah, right here. She'll sit up, and there's Frank. So we shot that much later.
That's an actual vintage
sweater.
Sweater.
Yeah, I like that sweater.
Fair Isles.
Or die trying. And that is episode 103, ladies and gentlemen.
It is.
Any final thoughts, Tara?
I'm really, really tired and I need to go to bed.
And there you have it.
Now,
well, thank you for joining us, and we will talk to you again soon, probably for episode 104, The Gathering. Until then, thank you for joining us.
It's my team.
Good night.